Good morning. Welcome to BRK 3267. This is 7697, installing and configuring Windows 10.
It's actually 698, so don't get up and leave.
Okay, yeah, 698.
698.
Yes, what he said, 698. But if you're interested, 697 is after this course, so. It's interesting because they actually flipped it. You would have thought 697 first and then 698, but that's fine. We have a great show for you today either way. My name is Alfred Ojukwu. I am from the New York, New Jersey region in Microsoft Consulting Services. I'm also a Microsoft certified trainer.
And I'm Joe Lurie. I am also a consultant with Microsoft Consulting Services in the Northeast. I'm based out of Boston. Go Sox, excuse me. Oh, I guess I'm still up. All right, so as a consultant, I primarily deal with a configuration manager with Windows upgrades, both client and server upgrades. I am an MCT. I've been a certified trainer since 2000. I actually now just hold a MCT alumni because I don't teach classes anymore. And I have my little fun fact there that even though I work in the technology field, I have never seen a single Star Trek or Star Trek movie or TV show of any of the series of Star Trek TV shows. Never saw a single bit of any one episode.
I've been telling them for years.
See,
now.
I don't even know what that even means.
I keep trying to sneak it into the slides so you can actually watch it. All right, we'll keep going. My name is Al. Okay, you guys already know who I am. I spent a lot of time with doing podcast, internal training, and also run a blog, The Device Pros. I spend a lot of time, working out, as you can probably tell, and really enjoy traveling. So I'm really looking forward to just being, interacting with you guys, answering questions you might have, and just really getting into the content as we go through. Now, bear in mind, we have a number of slides. I'm not even going to tell you the number, but it's a good number of slides. The reason why we have a lot of slides is because once you have the slides, there's a lot of information that will help you prepare for the 698 exam. Now, the 698 exam is literally just coming out of beta. So I was going to ask the question, how many people have taken the 698 exam? Yeah, unless you are an MCT or a tester or a trainer, I had one person in the back, I'm not going to put his name.
How many people here, you just show of hands, have taken an exam in the last 6 months? So less than half the room. How about the last 12 months? Okay. So we're at about half the room.
3 years. Okay. Other
How many
question?
Have never taken an exam? All right, cool.
No, that's actually...
It's good.
Did some of you guys raise your hands twice on that?
I took it, but I didn't pass. Do I raise my hand? Not raise my hand.
Excellent. So there are three sections in this exam, and if you've seen any of the other Windows 10 or mobility exams, they usually have 6 to 9 different sections. This new exam has 3 sections, but it's really like loaded with content in each section. Primarily implement Windows, configuring support core services, managing and maintaining Windows. We're going to do our best to kind of go through each one of them. We'll talk about it. We'll give you exam tips as we're going through this. Our intention is not to just talk about what's on the exam, but talk about how to prepare for it as you go into the exam.
Yeah, to add to that, if you don't know anything about installing, maintaining, managing Windows 10, you've never looked at Windows 10 before and you walked into here, you're not going to pass the test when you leave this room. We're not teaching you deep dive all the material on the exam. Again, we're going to do our best to deep dive a lot of the material, but not all of it. And we're going to show you the slides and help you prepare for how they may word a question on the exam around some of this material.
The first section is preparing for installation requirements. So we start off just determining what the hardware requirements are, determining how to do the upgrade, whether to do a clean install, and we'll go through each one of this. These introductory slides is just to make sure you guys know what that portion covers. The content goes right into the details. So we start right in discussing what Windows 10 requirements are, and we have them listed here. We start off with understanding what those requirements are at a minimum. So what you're seeing here are the minimums. They will ask you questions on the exam. Do you understand the minimums? If you're having a case study that's dealing with making sure that they have, you know, virtual machines running at a certain minimum. You want to make sure that you've met that requirement, most likely what we have up here, as you can see. Yes. The question is, are the slides downloadable? We want to make sure, we're going to check with the presenter.
Content owner.
The content owner, yeah. And he's going to make sure it's available. And if not, just make sure you email the Ignite folks. But we'll make sure it's available for you guys.
We were told that all these slides will be available after the fact, within 24 hours, maybe a little more than that. But, we haven't actually seen it.
We won't stop you from taking pictures, though.
Right.
Yeah, if you didn't take pictures, this will be weird. So know your hardware requirements for Windows 10. Very first thing, it always talks about minimums because it wants to, the customers want to maximize the amount of requirements that they, maximize what they can run. So know your minimums. Then we talk about preparing. When you're preparing for Windows 10, we really dive into just application compatibility. How many people have run the ACT tool, work with that? Yep. So this is basic ACT. How it runs, knowing the latest version that's running with Windows 10, and what it can do, right? So both the hardware compatibility toolkit as well as ACT are very important. This one's talking about the MAP toolkit, the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit. What this does is it basically scours your network for systems to determine whether or not they're ready to go to Windows 10. So it's going to look, it's an agentless application that basically pulls back information like, information around, what type of systems are running, whether or not they're ready for migrations, whether they're Hyper-V supportable. You get all that information back, and as a business, you can actually make a decision as to whether or not you're ready to move to Windows 10. In the exam, they're looking for you to understand that the MAP toolkit is probably the first thing you're going to do in preparation to go to Windows 10.
Right, you can use the MAP toolkit to discover the systems on your network either by Active Directory OU or by subnet even, or by Active Directory domain. It uses WMI queries, so it connects to the machines. As Alfred said, it's agentless, so there's nothing actually running on the system. It just sends a WMI query and says, give me what you got, and then you put it into a database. And you can see what's available, what is running at least the minimum hardware requirements.
Once we get past the hardware requirements, we start looking at what are our deployment options? How do we go about pushing Windows 10? We've now made a decision that Windows 10 is what we want to go to, and we start thinking about what those options are. And we've listed three of them out here, which is the first being wipe and load. We'll go into more detail on each one of these. You can see that the idea of wipe and load is to capture the data settings, deploy the OS image, and then we'll go into in-place upgrade, which doesn't require a wipe and load, and provisioning packages, basically in a scenario where you have a choose your own device type scenario. So how do we make those options available? So options for deploying Windows 10 kind of walk you through deciding. If you have a new device, typically what you want to do is start off with a bare metal or a custom image that's available for that new device. But you also want to consider a number of things. Is it going to be a BIOS? Is it going to be UEFI? You have to make that decision. I know a lot of companies are looking at deciding whether or not they want to move to UEFI. They might have older systems, but most new systems now come with UEFI. A few years back, some systems were still being upgraded to BIOS, but if you're starting with new hardware, and typically with this exam, because it's such a new exam, they're going to be looking at you to understand why UEFI, how to get from BIOS to UEFI, and in which scenario BIOS to UEFI matters. You'll look at things like third-party disk encryption. Is that a preventer that's going to prevent me from going from the current platform, existing device, to a new system? WinP offline operations. You're going to also consider things like, the architectures, a 32 or 64-bit architecture. Do I have local admins running on there? And am I moving from an older version like Vista or XP even? How many people are still running XP?
The rest of you can raise your hands. You don't have to be shy. There are still companies out there running Server 2003 and Windows XP.
No, that's fine. And that's understanding what your operating systems are because you want to get them. You want to get to Windows 10. And then you're going to think about the application considerations. you know, bulk app changes, if I have a number of applications that need to change, whether or not it's easy for me to upgrade them and fix those apps, or whether I want to just do a full reinstall, even use MDT or some sort of automation deployment tool to actually get to the latest version. So if you go through those options, you kind of think about, are any of these things a concern? The first thing you want to think about is doing an in-place upgrade. And that's kind of the decision process. So as you're going through your exam, you're thinking about all these things that are being asked in the questions. Are they asking me about, you know, what architecture? Are they asking me about the offline operations? So we wanted to share each one of those with you. Now, if any one of those things are an issue or have a problem as part of what you're doing with your deployments, you typically want to think about doing a wipe and load, which is basically refresh of the system and starting fresh.
So right now, there's actually no supported way to go from BIOS to UEFI on an in-place upgrade, and there's no supported way to go from 32-bit to 64-bit in an in-place upgrade. So, for example, in those two cases, we would need to do a wipe and load.
So this goes into a little bit more detail about what wipe and load is. I won't go through the whole thing. The intention is to make sure you guys see it and understand what that process, the process is and how you can actually get there. It talks about using things like SCCM and MDT and just the customizations required if you're going to do an older version of Windows XP or Vista to Windows 10. The next piece also has in-place upgrade. So if you're going through the slides, these are the considerations or the things that you're going to think about as you're going to an in-place upgrade. What do I have to do to get to Windows Windows 10 if I have to do an in-place upgrade? And preferably, because that's the newest approach at getting to the latest platform, if you have exam questions, and there are some questions about how to do this, you're going to always try to lean towards in-place upgrade.
So in the last slide and this slide, see how we have it as kind of building the steps from starting your old OS to capturing the user state to installing the new OS to loading back the user state. That's the type of question you might see where you have a lot of, for those of you that have never taken an exam especially, you'll have a list of steps on the left-hand side that has to be dragged over to the right-hand side in order. You have 10 steps on this side, you only need 5 of them on this side. So drag the appropriate steps in the appropriate order. You might see start your original operating system, run scan state, load the new operating system, run load state, and then log into Windows 10.
We've also listed out a number of considerations for in-place upgrade, the reasons why you would do it. Again, I'm big on paying attention to case studies. Again, another exam tip, when you get in there, read through the case study, understand what they're asking for. Sometimes in the exam room, it probably takes you about 5 minutes to just read through a single case study. I typically have to read a couple lines over and over again. And the strategy is, as you're taking the exam, take some notes on the side. You have a piece of paper, put the notes that really matter to you, the things that stood out, so that when you go back to the question, you're looking for those key items or those key reasons why upgrading would matter. So we've listed out those reasons to consider when you're doing an in-place upgrade so that you're aware of it. I won't go through each one of it, but there's quite a bit of detail here, and we'll go into the next piece of it, which is provisioning packages. Now, how many people have you worked with the WICD or Windows Image and Configuration Designer? You like it?
Good.
It's okay. No, I'm not the PG. I'm just asking, see what people like. Provisioning packages are really cool. It's not re-imaging. In and of itself, it really is for providing employees or users with the ability to build their device fresh from the vendor or wherever they're getting the device and just push a package out to them and be able to install it. The secret is figuring out how do I get the package onto that device, whether it's by installation media or USB or pointing them to a share somewhere where they can actually pull those components down, and it basically configures the system to meet the requirements of the organization. Now the difference is when you're dealing with provisioning packages, it's a one-time configuration change. It's not like group policy. It's not like SCCM or any other tool that manages the system. It's a one-time change. So if you're going to use provisioning packages, do not use it as if it's going to be your compliance settings on the, on the system themselves. Compliance settings and other components should be applied on top of the image once it's been built to match the requirements of the organization. We have here just a quick example of what the provisioning tool looks like, where you basically start with it. You can basically view settings and policies of Windows 10 right in there, and you can start a new project where you're basically trying to find what it is that I want to configure. You name the project, and from there, you're going to decide, am I going to build a project to update the drivers? Am I going to build a set of files to basically manage any of the other settings that are on the that are going to be pushed to the Windows 10 system? This is typically installed with the assessment and deployment kit. And at that point, it has the information built in so that you can actually build what you need for the requirements of your provisioning package.
As a side note, Alfred just asked how many people have used WCD. Those of us from Boston do call it Wicked. It's because we just call it Wicked.
That's wicked smart of you. And you can define things like application and drivers in an answer file as well. And this basically just walking you through what you have to do to create that provisioning package. In the exam, you'll also have the ability to walk through processes. They might even test you on how do I create a provisioning package. First, I go to new project, select the driver. So expect this type of exam taking to show up in this scenario.
All right, so I'm just going to stop here for a second because there were a lot of people that raised their hand that have never taken an exam. So I want to go over just a couple of exam things. So in the olden days, or some exams you might be expecting, there were multiple choice. There were a lot of multiple choice, choose all that apply, choose the one that apply, and those still exist. But there's also things like case studies, like Alfred talked about before. You read a scenario, it's several paragraphs long, and then you answer five or six questions related to that scenario. If there's more than one case study, they're unrelated to each other. So you don't think about the information you read in one of them while answering questions in another one. There's also things like a hotspot. And you might see a hotspot in something like this, where there's a picture of the WCD provisioning tool, and you just have to click on the appropriate spot to add the driver package, or to add the provisioning package, or to add the application. And it's that easy. You just have you read the question, you see the picture, and you click right where you would normally do the whatever they're saying. Where should you click to get this done?
The thing that surprises people when they actually go in to take the exam is not realizing that it's changed in the last 4 or 5 years. There are so many other options. So by knowing that you may have to click through options and select or highlight certain things, you can actually prepare in the labs, by testing, walking through different scenarios on your own, so you know what the windows look like and you know what to expect when you're actually in the exam room. That way it builds your confidence. You walk in there, you take the exam, you do well on it.
Yep.
The other piece we want to mention is the Windows System and Image Manager. What do you guys call it in Boston?
Yeah, we just call it the Windows Sim. That's all. There's nothing special about it.
Just check in. I don't want to, And the difference here is that you can actually use an answer file, and you can make it part of MDT or WDS, make that answer file available. So if you have questions around what to use, the one key thing I'll just mention about WSIM is that you can have an answer file attached to it, and it can be integrated with MDT or WDS. So pay attention to the question as that comes up. That might be a clue to you how to move forward.
And for those of you that use System Center in your organization to do operating system deployments, don't assume every question is using System Center in their organizations to do operating system deployments. If it doesn't specifically say you're the administrative contoso and you use System Center to do operating system deployments, they don't use it.
Yeah, they're looking.
It has to say it in order for you to assume that they use it.
And I would even ask the question, how many people actually deploy images using WDS? So there's some of you out there. So ironically.
Desktop images using WDS or just server images?
Desktop.
Some people still do it. So the exam is looking for the most, sometimes they look for the simple answer, right? And because WDS has the ability to deploy images with it, it might be the easiest way and might be the right answer. So don't get confused, like he said, if you're looking for the term SCCM, then you can think about SCCM as part of the platform. Although WDS is part of what SCCM has in it anyways. And once you've done all that, you've prepared your image, you basically can then walk through the process of upgrading to Windows 10. I have a couple videos here that basically shows what that upgrade process is like. I don't think they're running. That one's a failure. I won't walk you through it, but let's just, you know.
Again, you have these slides. That's why we have this on here. So you can review this on your own when you look at it.
The idea was just to show this is what's going to happen when you do an upgrade. You probably can't see it, but each one of those are different. And you're expected to basically know how to upgrade to Windows 10 and what tools to use. This is showing you the different scenarios in which you're upgrading. And we'll talk about how to decide which options to go with. Okay, I won't let it go through all the way, but this is, if you haven't seen it, it's there, and you'll be able to look at it in the slides when you have a chance. Okay, now how do I get to Windows 10 upgrades? What's the path? This exam is more than just about what's going on today. It really is focused on, because the exam is so new, we can actually cover the details of what's happening. And so we'll start seeing that you have to be able to select the path and the technology that you're going to use. So from Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1 to Windows 10, you're always going to want to think about in-place upgrade using Windows Update Installation Media or its hash sequence. And all the way down to LTSB, which is an in-place upgrade.
So one thing to consider, like we have on the slide Windows 10 RTM. We have fall 2015, which was today. This recording might be, years down the line. So this is September something 2016. I don't even know what today's date is, but September something 2016.
28.
Thank you. So the exam itself, the questions were kind of written earlier this year, even before anniversary update came out. The questions are continually updated. So even though if you took the exam like yesterday, you probably won't see any anniversary update questions. If you take it tomorrow, you might. So we have up here just some, if you happen to take it before the questions get updated, RTM to the Windows 10 fall version. If you take it after it got updated, then we're looking at Windows 10 fall through summer 2016 anniversary update and so on and so forth after that. So the different upgrade paths that we have, you can see in the slide, and again, we're not going to go through all of them, but you want to go from Windows 8 or 8.1 Pro, you're going to go to Windows 10 Pro if you want to go from enterprise to enterprise, home to home. One thing you want to watch out for on the exam is things like your company is, and these exam questions aren't meant to trick you, but they do want to make sure you understand what the scenarios are at the company. So they may say something like your company has a mix of Windows 7, home, and Pro, and you want to set, you want to do an upgrade. Put the appropriate path down. The end result must all be Windows 10 Pro, right? So some of them might be a wipe and load, the Windows 7 home to Pro, and some of them might be an in-place upgrade. So you want to watch out for things like that.
Scan state, load state, and the migration files also come into play, making sure you know what USMT components to use for Windows 10. Windows 10 USMT only supports Windows 10 USMT. That's one thing I want to make sure you're aware of. They test you on the latest information, so keep that in mind. There are different versions prior to Windows, the USMT 10 that require multiple different USMT versions to be able to get to 10. And we'll look at that in a second. But for the exam, no scan state, no load state, and the command, you'll see a lot of command line requests on how do I actually use scan state and load state. And also knowing the difference between the MIG docs, MIG apps, and MIG users. The MIG apps, for example, MIG apps moves application information over from one system to another. MIG user uses a profile, and the docs obviously use the docs that the user has access to.
One thing you want to, how many of you have used USMT as part of your deployments? So that's more than half the room. So USMT, user state migration tool. We have on the slide here basically the order. Scan state is run, and that scans for the user's state data, and then load state is run on the new machine or on the upgraded machine to bring it all back down. Now, if you're going from an x86 or 32-bit Windows 7 to a 64-bit Windows 10, you can still use scan state and load state, but you actually have to use the architect architecture appropriate. So on the Windows 7 machine or Windows 8.1, you're going to use 32-bit scan state, and on the Windows 10, you'll use 64-bit load state.
And this kind of walks you through it. Again, just like in an exam, they might ask you, what are the steps to actually do X, Y, or Z? So in here, we have admin launches the scan state. The scan state reads the XML file that you've basically placed there, and scan state collects the data and places it in a stored location on your network.
So that stored location may be an SMB share on your network. It might be what we call a hard link. So a hard link, instead of storing it in a share on the network, actually marks it on the hard drive as don't delete this during the upgrade process, and it's part of the user state data. And then during load state, it looks for those hard links and it just restores it to the same location or the appropriate location, sort of my documents to documents type of thing.
Once the migration is done and the user goes back to pull the data, it will actually look for the load state settings where the file was stored, whether it be on the partition or whether it be on the network. And it loads, reads the supplied XML file, finds the information that's related to the user or the application or the documents that were scanned, and then writes it back to the location on the target system. Again, this is an example. This hasn't changed. This is an example of what you'd have to see or walk through in the exam. They may walk you through something and asking you to put them in the right order.
Also, keep in mind that if the user happens to be logged in and they notice that their state data didn't come back for whatever reason, it just didn't come back, and so the administrator, as it says there, administrator launches load state. That process can run, but the user will have to log off and log on again to actually see their new data or their old data.
So exam tip, think logically through the question that they're asking you. If you do this work on a day-to-day basis, knowing what steps you actually use to actually perform an action may save you an answer or two on the exam. Okay? And the options for the Windows 10, as we mentioned earlier, you can decide on, you have different versions of USMT. This might come up as well. If you're going from, for example, XP Pro to XP Pro, you're going to use 3, and so on and so forth. This chart may be good for you in general, for some of you guys that are working, you know, in this space, but also for the exam, sort of memorize it in a way of knowing, okay, Windows 10 really is only for Windows 10. And typically, they'll ask you questions about going from an older platform to Windows 10. And since we can only go from Windows 7 to Windows 10, as you can see here, you see the options that show up for getting to Windows 10.
All right, let's go over our first practice question. Your company's desktops run 32-bit Windows 7 with Service Pack 1. You are planning the migration to 64-bit Windows 10. You have confirmed that all the hardware is compatible with 64-bit Windows 10. The migration must meet the following requirements. User settings and files must be preserved during the migration. Existing hardware should be used. What is the best path for this migration? Should we suggest an in-place upgrade with a provisioning package, a wipe and load migration using USMT, an in-place upgrade, or a side-by-side migration? Okay, I think I saw a lot of hands come up with B.
How many people think it's B?
Oh, I'm not. How many people think it's A? It's okay, you can raise your hand. Sometimes, how many people think it's C, an in-place upgrade?
I'll just raise it.
All right, why isn't it C? Thank you. 32-bit, 64-bit, cannot be C. All right, side-by-side migration. Why not that one? Existing hardware should be used. All right, let's go ahead with the answer.
Okay, yep, so.
We moved the answers around right before while you're sitting there. The answer is actually a wipe and load migration.
I didn't know you put the animation in there. It's a good one.
He did. He actually moved A to B and put a new A in there. I don't actually know why he did that. But he did, and the answer is B, wipe and load migration. I wrote the question. It's a wipe and load migration.
It's wipe and load. Yeah, don't blame us. No, wipe and load migration. Just remember that. Okay. Now we move on to, now how do I decide which Windows 10 edition I need to install? So we've listed out all the editions on here and given you a brief description of why you would select one versus the other. Now, there's nothing trivial about this, right? Some of the similarities, I see a copy and paste there, but anyway, I see some of the similarities with Windows 10 and Windows 10 Pro.
One thing that you want to keep in mind, we know Home, Pro, Education, Enterprise, so How many of you work in education space? So there's a few of you. So education has almost all the same features as enterprise. It pretty much, it's going to be almost the same. But the LTSB version that we have in there, it's the long-term servicing branch, that's something new, where it's kind of like the old Windows 7 way to do things, where you basically you image the machine and 3 years later you image it again. That's the LTSB long-term servicing branch. That's different than a current branch for business. And we have slides coming up for those. So I'm not going to spend any time on them now. A long-term servicing branch is really meant for specialized warehouse machines or something that doesn't need anything special. Some things you lose with LTSB, so to keep in mind, is you lose Cortana. You lose Edge as a browser. So you lose basically anything that gets updated with the Windows Store.
I saw somebody sad over there.
During a normal update. Edge is good, and Cortana is awesome. So anyway, so anything that gets updated with the store, you would actually lose an LTSB because it's the idea of LTSB is it's not being updated regularly, like with the store.
And if you're going from LTSB, you're going to wipe it out and start over a new CB or CBB branch.
Yes, that's a good point. So going to LTSB, let's say you've done a CB branch, which again we'll talk about in a few minutes, but let's say you're there and you say, you know what, I think LTSB is better. That's a wipe and load. If you're on LTSB and say, you know what, I kind of like the servicing branch model, you can just change the SKU.
So here's a quick over on the virtual smart card, which is another component. We're kind of getting into the details of the OS itself. This is just talking about the fact that virtual smart cards might be required. We put in a command here that talks about how do I set up the virtual smart card on my device itself. So be familiar with that, the steps of creating a virtual smart card and the fact that you need TPM on there to actually do it. Additional general features that we see on Windows 10, these are the ones that you'll probably see more readily on the exam. We've listed them out here, Continuum, Cortana, Miracast, the touch component, OneDrive, and Sync Your Settings. All are things that you should at least have some familiarity with how they work and why they matter on the Windows 10 platform, as these are features that are now probably more spelled out on the Windows 10 platform. From a security perspective, you should be aware of things like BitLocker, device health attestation or DHA, secure boot, two-factor auth, a virtual secure mode, and as you saw earlier, the virtual smart card. Again, these are all newer components, so if you haven't yet sort of taken an exam, they're going to be looking for you to understand the difference between what secure boot is and what BitLocker provides. Even though they look like the same type of security features, they actually have two different functions. And could be, you know, night and day for you on the exam.
They do, and we have there with BitLocker that a TPM works with BitLocker, but BitLocker, some of you know, can be done without a TPM. So don't get stuck on that. It's not the best way to do it. TPM would be better, but it can be done without a TPM. If you are using BitLocker and Secure Boot, they both are going to use that TPM. The one TPM on your computer are both going to be used by the different features, independent of each other. So if you have Secure Boot done, let's say your machine is BitLocked and then you enable Secure Boot, your recovery key is most likely going to show up in BitLocker because something changed to the boot. So if BitLocker has been enabled and then you need to enable Secure Boot, make sure you pause BitLocker first. You don't have to turn it off, but make sure you pause it, enable Secure Boot, and then resume BitLocker.
And device health attestation is basically a way of monitoring your systems as they boot up into the organization to make sure that there are no threats on the device and make sure that it's consistently not being compromised during the boot. It's sort of a way of making sure you meet your device meets the requirements of your organization. So know the the different features in Windows 10 that are security based. And what we've done as well is just list out all those features that are available and the differences between Pro and Enterprise. Why? Because they will ask you a question, and if you're not paying attention to where it says Pro or Enterprise, you may realize that you're selecting something that doesn't exist on that platform.
So a good example of that is BitLocker, where BitLocker is available in Pro, and I could be wrong about this, but I think Windows 7 it may not have been. I could be wrong. It's been a while since I used Windows 7 Pro, but Windows 10 Pro, it does enable BitLocker. I mean BitLocker is enabled if you want it to be.
Yeah, I won't go through it because it's a lot of content. Install Windows. This is another section talking about, you know, what's the process of installing Windows. And we talk about the basic installation process. So they start from everything from how do I install Windows. We've listed out the command line switches. Again, TechNet is your friend. The switches are things that you literally just, you know, if you're testing, just to find out, setup.exe, you know, throw the image on your machine, setup.exe/?, and you'll be able to kind of see the details in terms of what switches I can use on the device themselves. This is just a quick experience, what that looks like. If you haven't seen it, just we all probably have done some level of upgrade on here. And nothing special here, but the idea is that if I'm, this is the user experience in terms of what's going to happen if I'm doing a media-based installation of Windows 10, and it goes through the process of getting to Windows 10.
One thing to note on that last slide is if your current system is, let's say it's Windows 7 and BitLocker is enabled, the Windows 10 setup will automatically pause and resume BitLocker as necessary. If it has semantics, whatever, disk encryption, MACV disk encryption, that is not going to be the case. So make sure you work with that third-party disk encryption vendor to see what's necessary during an upgrade to make sure that the machine is still is usable at the end.
But for this exam, if they do ask you a question around, do I need to disable BitLocker during the upgrade, Windows 10 doesn't require you. Do not need to disable BitLocker. It basically would suspend it for you during that upgrade process. We touch on this later on, the current branch versus current branch for business. We kind of show what that, the ability to delay that with a deferred upgrade. And this is the Windows update process when you just basically use the Woo-based installation. Most of us, if you're not already in the insider.windows program, it uses the same framework to get you to the latest version of Windows 10. Now, once we get into the basics of the operating system, we start thinking about the boot partition. Know the difference between boot partitions and system partitions. Boot partitions are for, it contains basically the files required to boot the Windows 10. The system partition, again, is the Windows system files that are used. And be familiar with the terms and commands that are used on your device to be able to see what's on the system itself. BCD edit is fairly new for the platform. If you're working with much older versions of Windows 10, you're probably going to ignore anything that isn't BCD edit.
We have disk management listed there as well, but also keep in mind things like disk part as an executable way to create partitions and move things around in the disk.
This boot option has just multiple screens that you'll be able, levels of options that you can select from if you have to explore each one of them to sort of figure out what you're looking for on the device. Another thing that comes up on the exam is boot to VHD or what we consider native boot, booting from the VHD, and how to set that up so that you can actually access a operating system that sits in a VHD file. Windows 10 and Windows 8 as well also allows you to create a VHD on that device itself and make it available as an operating system that sits in a file container.
Yeah, so most of us know VHD as Hyper-V, right, or VMware even, but we'll call it Hyper-V. That's what we think of with a VHD, a virtual hard disk, but we can boot to VHD without Hyper-V. This is part of our Windows 10 boot options.
Now, in real life, if you have BitLocker installed and all these components installed, boot to VHD may not be your friend. and you guys probably know this from first-hand experience. There's another feature that we don't have on any of these slides. It's nested VMs. How many people have worked with nested VMs at all? Pretty cool feature, huh?
How could that many have worked with nested VMs? They're like kind of new.
Well, I mean, I got to ask. I mean, they are at an Ignite conference.
No, they did. I mean, people raised their hand. It's kind of new.
Raise your hand again if you worked with.
Yeah, exactly. Server 2016 TP5, current version.
Okay, so fine. All right. Nested VMs are really cool, basically because you can actually host VM Hyper-V platforms on a Hyper-V system. Or VHD that's already been VM virtualized. So that's something that's new. You might see that on exam. We're not sure if that's something that you'll need to worry about, but make sure you know about it. This exam is still fairly new, but I don't know how new it is in terms of the fact that nested VMs are fairly...
More likely, this is not going to be... Today, September something 2016. There's not going to be any Server 2016 questions.
It was on the practice test.
No
messy. The comment was that was on the practice test. Okay, so, all right. There you go. What's that?
Well, no, practice is fine. Yeah, practice is fine.
All right, so we have a couple of sample PowerShell commands there. We talked about the different types of questions you might see in the exam. One of the other types of questions is there'll be PowerShell nouns, or, I'm sorry, verbs, you know, get VHD, new VHD, mount VHD. These are different commands that you have to drag from one side of the screen into the appropriate location on the next side of the screen, or even click drop downs to put in the appropriate verb or action.
Also, they'll ask you things like, you know, how do I change a language during the upgrade process? And this gives you the ability to run DISM, for example, and choose the option to change the language to a specific language if you're having to address it for a different region. A lot of times, this was a big complaint that came up way back when, but I think with the changes, you'll have that as an option. So just keep in mind that that might come up. And we mentioned the disk encryption scenarios that you have to kind of be aware of. Like BitLocker is much easier now. The fact you can do the upgrade without having to worry about the disk encryption being turned on. We talk about configuring devices and device drivers. I'm going to go a little quick through these slides, so if you're taking pictures, better click, 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 click. device drivers are part of this. Things to be aware of, the gotchas that show up, like, for example, if I have display drivers or Bluetooth drivers or anything like that, it may sometimes force you not to be able to do the upgrade, and you have to basically uninstall those drivers. Know those sort of things. That's more of a real-life scenario. For the exam, they're looking for the practical, basic, you know, how do I do an upgrade? But this may be things you'll see in a real-life scenario where you have to actually disable Bluetooth. I haven't seen it in a while, but it was there when we first started doing all these upgrades. Yeah. The Bluetooth driver would have to be uninstalled or disabled to be able to move forward with the migration, or the upgrade, sorry. Next section goes into performing post-installation and configurations. What do I do now that I have my image, now that I've deployed it and I have it running? What do I need to see on that system? And we see some of those features that we mentioned earlier, one of them being Cortana, the fact that you can enable it during the boot process, during the configuration process, something to keep in mind. And we've listed out some of the available options that are available with Cortana. Again, we all have them on. If you have a Windows 10 device, what my ask is that you actually just go in there, play around with it, look at the buttons, the settings that are in there. I've listed them out here, probably a lot more than I have time to go through, but it's easy enough for you to see them because when you're in the exam room, you can know which options are available. And you can see before, it is enabled by default, but if you want to use it, you have to actually opt in to use Cortana and turn off the settings like Hey Cortana and a number of other things. And at that point, it becomes part of your user experience. Again, remember, Cortana is not a feature that's on LTSB. If you get a question about it, that's basically your answer. Or not answer, depending on what it is. Hyper-V client. Again, we had the mention of nested VMs. Something you should be somewhat familiar with, know exactly, you know, how to get around the Hyper-V client. It's meant to match what they're doing with the Windows Server, and they've added a configuration version so you can kind of keep an idea of what version of the client that it was created with. So I want to make sure I mention that. We talk about how do you enable Hyper-V. Again, you might have to walk through the process of enabling it.
So Hyper-V is installed as a role feature. It's a role on the Windows 10 machine, so first install it. You have to have it enabled or have a SLAT processor. There's hardware requirements for Hyper-V as well. So make sure that's enabled BIOS, virtualization is enabled in BIOS, and then you can install the role and just use the Hyper-V manager to manage your Hyper-V installation.
Also be familiar with the changes in the actual UI of the client Hyper-V settings. For example, it's no longer called snapshots. If you remember previous to Windows 10, they were called snapshots.
Right.
Now they're checkpoints. Checkpoints, you can have administrative checkpoints where you basically, production checkpoints where you basically have a standard checkpoint. whenever you need to have a backup of that operating system or that the VHD that's running on the system, or you can have just standard checkpoints as well. So checkpoints have become a little bit more emphasized in the newest version, so keep that in mind as you're going through the exam. We've also added a couple PowerShell commands that you might want to reference, get VM checkpoint, you know, restore VM checkpoint, all built into it so that you can actually do all the commands. Again, PowerShell is very important for this exam. And this kind of shows it. There you go, right up, bring it up front. Then we go into the implementing Windows in the enterprise, in the enterprise environment, and what's required there. We mentioned the WCD tool again, so I won't go through this one again.
Wicked tool.
Wicked.
The wicked provisioning tool.
How many people think it's wicked?
That is a wicked provisioning tool.
How many people think it's WCD? Come on, man.
Go Boston.
All right.
This room is Boston strong.
I'm going to call it Windows Image and Configuration Designer from now on out. Say the whole thing. All right, so same process. You see it, how it works. And then we get into the activation methods. KMS and MAC keys. KMS and MAC keys. I see this all the time. Know the difference between KMS and MAC keys. A lot of times when you're doing your testing and your deployment, labs and things of that nature, we typically ignore KMS and MAC keys. And I see a lot of people go in there thinking that they have a full understanding of Windows 10. Then you get hit with KMS and MAC questions. And you're like, whoa, you know, I forgot to test on that. So make sure you know when you're going to use MAC keys. Make sure you know when you're going to use KMS, which one is for enterprises. For example, the MAC is more for like a single activation where you have a single, you want to, you know, get things up and running quite quickly, and the KMS, you have to have a server infrastructure in place to support it. Now with Windows 10 and a number of other features, you can actually integrate it into Active Directory so that the machine that's domain joined automatically becomes activated.
And then reactivates itself every 30 days.
Every 30 days,
whatever it is.
It checks in every 30 days. So we've listed a number of activation options. The ones that are probably the most interesting is the activation states, finding different activation states. Know your switches, know your command lines, because they will ask you questions based on those command lines. We talk about, I've left this in here because this is more focused on the activation option that you would do in an Active Directory-based activation environment. And if you wanted to validate what that looked like, you could actually pull it up on your system, I think I have it here, and see exactly what version of the volume license client that you're actually running. Other components that you'll see in the exam is the UAC, the user account control settings. Nothing much has changed here. Same process, make sure you understand how UAC works, what settings are best for certain scenarios, which one's more secure, which one's less secure, and the value of having UAC. So if you do have a question on UAC, a lot of times it's really to negate the fact that it may not be the answer. At least that's kind of how I think about it.
In some cases, you'll see that you're upgrading from Windows, and I will just say Windows XP to Windows 10, so you're going to do a wipe and load. But your applications are going to be installed in the Windows XP machine. All users were administrators in the Windows 10 machine. They're standard users, and some applications are failing, you know, and UAC may be the reason. Or you could also go to the application compatibility toolkit, so that's another tool that you might use to see if that's an issue. But you may see stuff like the users used to be admins, and on the new OS, they're not admins. So think about UAC in that case.
So we have this slide here, and I'm not going to go through it. What we wanted to show you here are the differences between functions that required elevations and functions that don't require elevations. Again, another way they ask you questions on the exam is really looking to find out when you'd use certain functions versus when you wouldn't. For example, if I need to change the user's account password or change my account password, I don't need to have an elevation for that. A lot of times, some of those things look like things that you might need elevation for. We listed out the ones that require elevation, like installing or removing apps, all the way down.
And there may be more things like, you know, whatever. But, you know, no elevation required. Even adding printers no longer requires an elevation.
Yep.
We don't have it listed, but it doesn't.
Group policy still matters. We still see that group policy can control things like start screen,
universal app management, all the way down to the edge settings. So you may have questions around group policy. Know when to use them, know when they matter, and even more so, be able to kind of call out what's being added in group policy. Typically, to think about it, any new feature, or most new features that we have with Windows 10 have some sort of group policy built into it. So make sure you're kind of paying attention to where that shows up in your local group policy settings.
So for those of you that did take that practice exam, did you get any questions about group policy?
Now you're really digging into it, aren't you?
Well, I'm going to say, because when I took the practice exam just a few days ago prepping for this, I saw a question about you're upgrading Windows 7 Home and Windows 7 Pro. Oh, no, Windows 10 Pro. You know, and you need to set a registry setting. I forget what it was. And that was actually running a regedit command instead of using group policy. So it sounds like you should almost always use group policy because you can deploy it to so many systems at once. But keep in mind, things like Home Edition doesn't use group policy. That's a Pro and Enterprise and Education Edition feature.
Good tip. Active Directory still matters. That's really all this slide is saying. If you're an Active Directory administrator, just know the difference between sites, forests, domain trees, et cetera. Although this exam is focused on client-based requirements, you still have to know how that's being managed in an enterprise scenario. So we've also put the Active Directory Administrative Center, which is a newer component to the Active Directory Users and Computer component. It's a very light, interactive way of managing users in an Active Directory environment. So you may get questions around the ADAC and the fact that you can use PowerShell to control some of those settings about users and groups in Active Directory and devices as well.
And just as a little side note, that Windows PowerShell history in the bottom left corner, that is something new to the latest version of ADAC, which actually, if you click on it, it'll show you the last several things that were done. Even if you went and clicked on a user and then clicked change password, it shows you the PowerShell equivalent of what happened behind the scenes.
There you go.
All right, practice question. You're planning your company's UAC policies. Need to provide the security team with a list of actions which do not require UAC. Which of the following actions do not require UAC? Select three. Installing updates, configuring Windows update settings, installing device driver from a USB drive, pairing a Bluetooth microphone and headset, configuring Windows firewall settings, configuring accessibility options. All right, so there's three right answers here. Who thinks A? Okay, most of the room. Who thinks B? Right, a couple of people in the room. Who thinks C? Okay, a couple of people. Who thinks D? Most of the people in the room. Who thinks E? Alfred only. Who thinks F? All right. Go ahead.
Who thinks all of the above?
I don't think we moved these around, so these flash outs should be right.
So yeah. Let's see. Yeah. All right. So A,
do
D.
You may have to go back and go forward again.
Yeah.
A, D, and F. Installing Windows updates, pairing a Bluetooth microphone headset, and configuring accessibility options. All the rest of them do require UAC. Configuring Windows firewall settings does require UAC, but like opening the firewall from the control panel does not. So you can open it, you just can't do anything with it. All right, so we have a couple of tips here for you.
That was part one.
That was the first section, and it only took a...
Okay, yeah. Let's keep
going. All right, so tip number one, know the USMT order of operations. Again, you scan the user state, install the new OS, load the user state, and then log in. You know when to use an in-place upgrade versus a wipe and load. Know the different activation methods. We just talked about Mac and KMS keys. And as of today, September something 2016, exam does not include anniversary edition specific group policy settings or system settings. Again, that's as of today, as we're in here today, September something 2016. Go ahead.
All right, so the next section is configuring and supporting core services. We may go a little quicker, but again, mainly because this is not new content for many of you, we'll try to focus more on the newer content. IPv4, IPv6, .NET, DNS requirements are all sort of things that if you've been an administrator, much hasn't changed. They're really challenging you on what has changed. So that's what we're going to try to focus on. One of the big things that we know has changed is the settings app. The difference between the control panel and the settings app becomes something that you have to kind of think about. Terms to know, as we mentioned, nothing new, IPv4, subnet mask, DNS addresses,
and just knowing the difference between public and private addressing. We have class A, B, and C, as well as your different subnet masks that you might actually select.
You actually may need to do a little bit of subnetting. So back in the Windows 2000 and maybe even Server 2003 Windows XP exams, we did some subnetting. And then the Windows 7, we kind of didn't do subnetting anymore in those exams. And now we're back to doing having to know how to do subnetting, CIDR notation and things like that.
In your device, also be able to kind of look around in the network locations. How do I enable different networks? How do I change networks? Know the difference between, like I said, the settings app for networks and the actual control panel setting for seeing different sort of networks. We can see we have three different type of networks, domain networks, private networks, and guest networks. Look at the scenario that's being presented to you. Know which one's much more secure. For example, guest networks are more public, or guest networks are typically more secure because there are things like where you would work at Starbucks or a coffee shop. You'd want to select it for a guest network versus a domain network, which is considered to be more secure because it's
already managed. Yeah, he said that kind of backwards. So the guest network is less secure.
You know what? You guys get it, right? No. And the other thing is also know that you will always get a prompt depending on which network you're joining, whether or not you want to share information. And depending on that network, you're going to just either select yes or no. And same component, Windows Firewall has the same requirements where you're basically determining what the default states are. Know your PowerShell commands for Windows Firewall. This one's not as important, but the one that's probably more important is your advanced firewall settings. Know the difference, how to configure things through the advanced firewall. They will challenge you on this. They'll ask you to go to the advanced firewall location and sort of be able to understand what options that are available through advanced firewall settings.
And how many people here have used NetSH commands in the last year? All right, so most of you.
No,
you have to get back to your NetSH commands. The exam assumes that you're using NetSH commands, and most of you are. So make sure you, especially with advanced firewall specifically.
But even more importantly, PowerShell comes into play in this space too. So the get-net firewall command, enable net firewall, all those things are now becoming part of the challenge. So be able to know what the command is saying, because they might have one that says NetSH advanced firewall, and they might have one that says get net firewall, request. One's a PowerShell, one's basically a command line. And you'll need to know exactly what you're trying to do to get the right answer. Wi-Fi settings, you also see them here, where you can actually decide between different modes, Wi-Fi direct, standards that you're looking for, and the different levels of Wi-Fi security. Be familiar with what WEP is versus Wi-Fi protected access and the WPA2. Anything you want to add that?
Nope.
Okay. And lastly, troubleshooting networks. Be able to use PowerShell to troubleshoot networks. We have a quick sample command of resolving DNS names where you can just type in resolve-DNS name, give the URL or the address or the network address that you want to go to, and it will pull up information about that DNS address that you have as much as it can and provide it to you so that you know what you're accessing from where.
That's you, by the way.
So these are troubleshooting steps. Again, this is a logical process of thinking about what is it that I'm troubleshooting and how do I get to the right answer.
So another practice question on this. You're the help desk technician at Contosa.com. A user calls you because they are unable to access a resource on server one. You ask the user for the IP address of the computer and walk the user through getting you that information. The exam's not going to get that technical.
I did.
Anyway, the user's IP address is displayed to the right. Fun fact, I did that in Paint. I actually had to type it all out. I didn't do any copying and pasting. What should you do? A, add a default gateway to the network interface card, NIC, IPv4 properties of computer 1. B, enable IP routing on computer 1. C, check the DHCP server to see if it's online and has IP addresses available. D, check the DNS server to see if it's online and able to resolve server 1 to an IP address.
Anyone want to guess?
Yeah, so what you're looking at here is...
I think it's C.
The IP address being 169.254.something.something, right? That's the 8-pipe automatic private IP addressing, which means you are configured to use DHCP, but you can't get an IP address from from any DHCP server on the network.
Good guess, guys. Configuring storage is the next section. We talk about disk volumes, VHDs, removable devices, and storage spaces. Storage spaces probably being one of the coolest features that are built into the Windows 10 platform as well. The configuring disk, again, nothing new here. Make sure you know the difference between mirrored, span, striped, MBR, and GPT, master boot records, grid partition table. Knowing this is one of those, going from UEFI, BIOS to UEFI, one of those other components that you all get challenged on. GPTs are for much larger disk. MBR is the older format for the master boot record. And know your file systems. EFS being the newest one, resilient file systems. The reasons why you would use EFS over NTFS and the benefits that you could actually get from it. We also have in here, this is an age-old one, configuring shared folder permissions. I won't go into detail on this because we all do file and folder share permissions. If you don't...
But one thing to mention, we have the note, the SMB share permissions are ignored if you're accessing it locally, right? So if you access it WAC server 1 WAC share name, the share permissions are taken into consideration when giving your effective permissions. If you are RDPing into the server, it doesn't care what your share permissions are. Only the NTFS permissions, the security tab, is being looked at. So I just want to put that note. And that's no different than it has ever been from NT4, maybe even before that. My beginning was NT4. So that's not different, but it's something that people do forget about.
We mentioned storage spaces. Again, this might be an option on the exam. The reason why storage spaces become really sort of a cool way of thinking about, you know, disk is because it actually allows you to pool disk together. If you have a number of disks on your system or you have more than one hard drive, you can actually pull it together and allow it to create anything from a, you know, simple or two-way, three-way mirroring on that device itself. You also have the option to do thin or fixed provisioning using the virtual disk or using the storage spaces. It's available now. It's something that you might get tested on. Know the difference between what managed storage spaces give you on your Windows 10 device. Next section goes into data access and usage. And as I mentioned, each one of these sections, this is a part two, it has a lot of information in each one of these. So it's very important to know, hey, this comes up again. It's like, you know, implementing, I know why that's in there now. implementing apps is another section. This goes back to the apps themselves. Focus on anything from the Windows Store for Business, and many of the components that fit in. The Windows Store is, you will get challenged on the Windows Store. It makes you understand when you're going to use the Windows Store in your platform. Simple enough, when you go to your Start menu, you can actually click on Store, or you can type in Store. It takes you to the Store page, and you'll see that you'll be able to use it. You can basically manage it using Office 365 or Intune or even DISM. Typically it requires you have a Microsoft account to be able to access it. Now with the Windows Store for Business, you can actually use your corporate identity, whether it's synced with Office 365, to access the Business Store and see private applications, which we'll talk about in just a second. Or now, right?
Yeah,
right. Here are the details. Windows Store for Business. The more details around what you can do with it. There was a need to manage, you know, corporate data in the same location as the public applications. So the Windows Store for Business was created. So that means only you, if you as an administrator provision an app, a Windows Store app for your organization, you can actually select which groups or users have access to see that, and they will be able to see it in their private store.
Right, so they basically go to Microsoft.com/EN/US/business store, business-store, and sign in with their O365 address. And I think we actually have a bunch of screenshots here. So sign in through O365, and then you read and accept the EULA. It's very long, but make sure they do read and accept it. And then you can, you know, what apps they see are basically available for them to choose from. So get the app, and then...
The app to your private store. This is the administrator adding it to the private store because they want to make it available for their organization. And then from there, you can activate or enable the Intune integration. Yep. In other words, having it delivered through Intune, make it available on the device that the user's running, and then making sure that the student teacher can now show or shop for the apps as they need. So they're just basically going to
their device, logging on with their username, and the application show up as an option. Also with Windows Store app, remember that you can actually place the data on different partitions. And you can have it available as a download as you need. So it also shows you information around how much space is being used. Again, anyone familiar with appwiz.cpl, what that is, or the term appwiz? Yeah, it's shortcut to it. Now, you know, you just type in apps and you'll be able to get to the apps and feature location or go to the Windows key I. Again, just little tips that I'm giving you guys. And you'll be able to see the details of the apps that are installed. For those of you that aren't familiar, I'll just mention this. It took me, 2 years to realize apps are actually for Windows Store apps, and the word applications are really binaries that are installed in your local machine. So anytime you see the word apps, APPS, they're referring to a shorter...
Store apps, yep.
Yeah. So, thanks. See? It took me a while. I got it now.
Formerly known as modern apps.
Yeah. And Windows Store apps, again, you can here's what you can do with it. We give you those options. Think about what you're doing with those apps. They're all available. And we've given you a couple command lines on how to provision apps that you've created, you know, sideloading apps, sideloading store apps. You may be asked questions on how to do that, and here are the PowerShell commands to make that available. If I'm going to do some level of assessment and deployment, here are the tools that I'm going to use to actually get it done. Windows Assessment Deployment Kit, ADK, if you haven't used it, we've put it on here. The benefits of using ADK, it helps you make the decision when you're in the exam and they're asking you pick one of these four that will help you, you know, manage your image. What are the requirements in the ADK? So we threw out the deployment tools, the pre-installation environment, and the WIM and configuration designer, for example. All the others you may not enable, but they'll be available on your ADK platform. MDT 2013 yep. Update 2. Know which version that you need to manage your deployments. Again, typically, if you're not doing SCCM, you're probably doing MDT as a lighter component of
that. So you can see what we're doing here in the last couple of slides and this slide as well. We're throwing out some tools, and we've looked at Wicked a couple of times so far, but we're throwing out some tools that you can use. So make sure when you download these slides, you pay attention to those, because on any single question, you may have A, B, and C, maybe these three tools, plus a fourth, whatever it happens to be. And you know, need to know when to use the use case in each one of them.
These CERT prep exams are much different than many of the other sessions you actually attend, mainly because we're trying to put information out there. They give us 75 minutes to cover the content. We want to give you content you can walk out with to take the exam. And by the way, you want to mention about the exam?
You can take the exams. Am I? Yeah. You can take the exams here at Ignite, right around the corner. So when you walk out of this, take a left, and the half price while you're here. There's practice exams in one room right down the hall. Right next to that, you can sign up to take your exam. Again, it's half price as long as you sign up for it here and take it here. And then down the hall from there, you can actually take the exam.
Just a little segue. All right. Remote management is also in this section. This is all talking about RDP, remote desktop connections. Just know your settings. I've just basically listed them out here. Nothing special about them.
Right. There's not a lot of changes, if any at all, to Windows 10 remote desktop connections, except maybe security connecting to an older machine connecting to Windows 10. But you want to, you know, a lot of us have never looked at local resources or experience. Right. Make sure you have. Again, you may see hotspot questions or something like that.
We see a lot of people stick to the general tab and never go to the others. So as you're doing your testing, your evaluation, check out each one of those tabs, see what they look
especially
like.
Especially the check boxes at the bottom, persistent bitmap cache, or reconnect if the connection drops, stuff like that.
Okay.
All right, either administrator for Contoso or username Jane attempts to access a resource on server one named LegalDocs, whack whack server one, whack LegalDocs, was denied access. She then uses remote desktop to connect to server one, opens File Explorer, and is able to access LegalDocs. You, in your mind, are thinking, why does she have remote desktop access to server one? Don't think of that. You'll go crazy. She just does. You need to make sure when Jane attempts to access LegalDocs, she is denied access. All other users should not be affected by any change you make. You connect server one through computer management, expand shared folders, click LegalDocs, and then click properties. What should you do next? On the share permissions tab, add Jane's account and select deny read. On the security tab, add Jane's account, select deny read. On the general tab, change the user limit to 0. On the general tab, change the share name to LegalDocs$. Who thinks?
Take a guess.
Shout out the answer. We're out of time. Just shout out the answer.
Man. There you go. Excellent.
Oh, was that no animation on that one?
It did. It was all right. Said B, right?
All right, so a couple more tips for you. Again, refresh yourselves on how to do subnetting, CIDR notation, you know, borrow bits from one side to add to the other side. Refresh, because you may have a couple of IP subnetting questions. Keep in mind, you'll have a couple, right? When you want to focus your studying on something you know versus you don't know, you'll have a couple on IP subnetting, where you may have several on, you know, WCAG or deployment. NetShell and NetSH is still relevant, so be familiar with some of the NetSH commands, and folder permissions haven't changed, but so know the relationship between shared and NTFS permissions.
Last section, manage and maintain. This is all about updates, upgrades, and everything else. So you can see we've gone one, installation requirements, two, managing and configuring, and then updating. All three different sections. Configuring updates. Now, again, some of this content we've covered in the last umpteen slides, so we may skip through that. We just want to make sure you're aware of them. For example, Windows update options, know your options for configuring updates and which one or which platform you're going to use. These are all four that we've listed, a quick sample a description of each one if you haven't seen them.
And again, don't assume that using SCCM for Windows updates if it doesn't say it in the question.
Also know that you can configure it through group policy if I want to do configuration updates, or I can actually see that in the advanced options. This is something fairly new with the latest versions of Windows 10. I can choose how the updates are installed. All the buttons are there. Make sure that you're familiar with that window, that setting in the Settings app. And I'm going to skip this because of time. We mentioned this a number of times, current branch for business. Current branch for business is the delayed version of current branch. Most businesses want the current branch for business because it allows them to have access to the bits that have already been tested by the consumer environment. We used to call it consumer branch or current branch, but that's really now the main release.
Yep.
Insider's preview are for those that are actually participating and testing and giving feedback on the latest version of Windows 10.
You'll get your bits before everyone else, you know, fast ring, insider preview.
LTSB is a long-term.
And LTSB, as we said, meant for, you know, machines in a warehouse that don't really need to be updated. They don't need Cortana. They don't need anything like that. You can use LTSB. Very easy to get out of LTSB, but not so easy to move into LTSB.
We gave you a little chart that shows the release cycle going from the engineering build all the way down to current branch for business, just so that if it's in the exam or if it has questions around what that model looks like, you have an idea. We also give service branch comparison charts. Now, again, we won't go through the comparison chart. It's something that you can reference as you're doing your additional studying and knowing the difference between one versus the other and when to select one versus the other. Managing updates are also available on your console itself. If you went into the appwiz.cpl, you can actually see those updates and select those as an option. We show the PowerShell command, get-hotfix, to determine what's installed and control it that way as well. We also have the ability to update store apps. So store apps are also updatable. Again, we know that we can actually go into the actual store app and update it. And the last section goes into monitoring Windows as well. So how do I do update history and rollback, making sure I know exactly what I need to have to update that system.
Can you go back up one slide? So in the interest of time, we're actually not going to have a chance to go through it. Each one of these has its own one or two slides. What I want to point out here is you can use Task Manager or Resource Monitor or Performance Monitor, Data Collector Sets, to find out what's happening either in real time or historical data reports. Know when to use which of those four tools: Task Manager, Resource Monitor, Performance Monitor, Data Collector Sets. So Task Manager, real time, you can stop a task from running. That hasn't really changed, but you can open Resource Monitor from Task Manager or from the start menu just typing in Resource Monitor, or really just Resource will also work. So, and from Resource Monitor, you can also see real time, but you can see other information as well. From Performance Monitor, you can take a history and do baselines. These are some of the things that you'll want to make sure you understand when to use each one of those four tools. And
Yep. So I mentioned that before. Which tools for the job, just known exactly? I think he just talked about that.
Yeah, just talked about that.
Event subscriptions, resource monitor. I'm going to click through some of this. Again, the slides will be available. I know. Click, 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 click. Performance monitor. Windows Defender is also an option. We have a bunch of command lines. Again, a lot of content in here. This last section is just about updates.
Windows Defender can be updated, the definition files through Windows Update. Just make sure you add that category for the Defender updates.
So these are all talking about recovery options. When do I do certain recovery options? And using a recovery drive. If I need to do a recovery drive, I have to have an external drive to do a recovery of a system itself. I can also do system restore. Know the difference in the different tools. I don't know if you mentioned that already. The data recovery tools, OneDrive, Backup Restore, WBAdmin, all different options to do a data recovery.
Know that OneDrive has a recycle bin. Most of us don't realize that, but there is a OneDrive recycle bin. If you connect to someone else's OneDrive and delete something by mistake, your OneDrive recycle bin will not have that. His OneDrive recycle bin will have that. He'll need to go to the recycle bin to undelete it.
And configuring authorization and authentication. Now, again, this is all about Windows 10, authentication and hello. So we won't be able to get through. We have about three or four more slides, a few more slides. I'm going to just kind of skip a few of them. Again, these are available for later on. And get right down to the services, task scheduler, good content. Do you want to do this?
No, we're going to go past.
Okay. So here are a few other tips to remember. Again, the content's available later. This is the full content of three different sections. We've made sure all of it's available, and then the number of related sessions. Again, a lot of information. Hopefully that was helpful for you guys. And we also want to mention the book that's available if you want to download that. And I think it's like a certain percentage off. And you can actually use it to prepare for the exam as well. So with that, we want to thank you guys for coming today. Really appreciate it.
All right.
And